Hello and welcome back to Kitchen Curiosity, the podcast that we explore people, stories, ideas, shaping food service and the hospitality equipment world. Today we're going to be talking about price versus quality, own brand versus big brands, and what really matters when it comes down to specifying equipment for real kitchens. I'm joined by Trevor Burke. Many of you know him. He's the Managing Director of Exclusive Ranges. Hello, Trevor.
Hello, Red. How are you?
I'm good. Welcome. Good. Welcome back. You're a veteran now of the podcast.
Exactly.
I'm also joined by Paul Crumpler, who's the National Account Manager for Exclusive Ranges and looks after Vian and one of their brands. Paul.
Hello, Red. Thanks
good to see you again. We're in the Cheese Grater at Lean Hall Building in one of our meeting rooms recording this podcast. So if you hear the air conditioning, we're not on a proper studio, but we made a studio. So we'll get on with the show. We're going to talk to Trevor, first of all, and then have a chat with Paul, and then we're all going to have a bit of a group discussion. So, Trevor, hello again, and welcome back. Thank you. Always good to see your face.
Very good. Always good to be here.
Smiling and positive and happy, and you know, you were on time, so...
Always.
So, you know, this is season three, and for some of the listeners, they may not have heard season one, but you were on the podcast season one, episode 8, if I remember, which is, I think, August 24?
Yes.
Time
flies.
Yeah,
with Tim Hughes.
Yeah?
Yes.
So we covered a little bit about your story, but if you don't mind, can we just recap on that a bit and talk a bit about how you got into food service equipment? And if people want to delve deeper into it, they can listen to that episode 8 of season one. But over to you.
Okay, so, yes, I revealed my early passion as a professional footballer.
Yes. And, which I think was quite a surprise to some people.
I think there was a little shock. Yes.
Because after that podcast, I actually got people messaging me saying, I never knew that much ever.
But it was a great time when you're young and everyone has their dream. And that was a brilliant part of my life. And I still follow football now and played until I was in my 30s at different levels. So it's always been part of what I've done. And it kind of led me into the food service business because my contract ended at Crystal Palace and I needed a job. One of the directors was a director at the Park Lane Hilton.
Okay.
And within the hotel industry, particularly along Park Lane in central London, there was an inter-hotel football tournament that went on all year round, and we played over in Hyde Park. And so the director at the Hilton was always on the lookout for good footballers to play in his, because he managed a football team as well.
Is that how you got the job at Hilton?
And it was exactly why I got the
job. Because you were a good footballer, because you were a good waiter or anything.
No, there was me and a guy called Roy Botterill, and we were apprentices together, and we got let go after a year of being a pro. And we both went to the Hilton as storemen.
Not as a doorman.
If I'd have been a doorman, I'd have still been there with the money they make. So we went and worked in the stores, but on the understanding that we played every Wednesday. And so Roy and I were still playing semi-professional football then. The deal was they'd let us off early to play midweek matches.
And suddenly Hilton became the best team ever.
And we won the league every year.
Seriously?
Yo, seriously, that was the deal. And so that kept everybody happy. And
so what was your first role like in our sector, if you like?
So I did that for probably 3 years, really. And it was fun. It was good fun. But then you realise that you've got to have a proper job. And then I was looking at the Evening Standard, so that's how long ago. And I saw this job for a storeman at Pages in London. And I didn't really know who Pages were, but I'd done a lot of work at the Hilton where I was in the general store, which looked after glass, china, linen, and, you know, shipped it around the hotel, stored it, got it delivered to all the different restaurants. So I was kind of familiar with that area. And I went to Pages for an interview. And it was when they were moving from the old showroom in Romney Street up to a new showroom north of Cambridge Circus.
On Shaftesbury Avenue.
So
they've just moved out of there, apparently.
I'm not sure, but when
they're around the corner for 3 years, apparently. But
when I went there, it was like being packed up. And I looked in the window and I thought, oh God, you know, who are these people? Look like they're going bust. Mm. I mean, so I knew nothing about it. And so, but what I did do, and it was from the football days really, because we used to have to turn up in matches in a jacket and tie. So I thought I'd turn up for my interview in a jacket and tie.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I walked in, said I'm here for the interview to be a storeman. And a guy called Nigel Lee, who was a manager, posh Yorkshire, very lovely man. He looked at me and said, you don't look very much like a storeman with a suit and tie. And I said, oh, but no, I've come for this. I'm nervous, obviously. I've come for the storeman's job. He said, no, no. He said, we could do better than that. He said, I think we could make you, you could be a salesman.
Oh, wow.
And you can sell cups and saucers, glass and china for us. Come and have a look at the new showroom. He walked me down to the new showroom. I met his boss, CMD, and I started off as a salesman in Pages and Shaftesbury Avenue.
Selling, which is now Nesbitt's.
Which is now Nesbitt's, selling glass and china. And I walked past there and it's still sold from that corner of the shop. And I used to sit there with a guy called Chris Hillis, Aussie. People used to wander into that shop with the most obscure pieces of glassware and plates, cups, saucers to match it up.
Seriously.
And Chris Hillis used to, he'd never call out. He would just look at that and say, oh, it's a Pilco number six or whatever it was. And so I learned a huge amount from him. I mean, a massive amount. And but you were only allowed to sell, it was very old school, you were only allowed to sell cups and saucers, glass and china.
Right.
Anything with a plug on was for another senior guy. And anything at the back of the showroom, like a cooker.
And right, so you had to literally stay in your
You had to give your customer up. So you had to sell him the glasses. So everything was done on commission. It was a big commission-led business. And so my commission number was 104. Mm. It's like a number you never forget, because when you made a sale, you had to make sure that the cashier lady
put it through the till.
Put it through the till with your number on. And at the end of every day, they'd push the till out with a till.
It sounds a bit like, are you being served?
It is totally like, are you being served?
Sounds weird, yeah.
And they'd push the till out and you would get the till roll and you'd have your number and how much you've sold that day.
Wow.
And every Thursday, they closed the week on a Thursday.
Do you mind me asking about revealing your age? What year was that?
So that was in, Isabel would be laughing now because I'm terrible at years, but that would be in sort of maybe 84, 85.
Okay, yeah, so we are going.
So back. I'm 63.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay. So I was in my early, I was in my 20s then.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so every Thursday, the till would roll out for your week's takings. So you could kind of calculate what your commission
what
might
you
be.
What you sold, what your commission was.
Yeah, exactly. So that was really important because it was a big part of your salary.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that when...
I bet you were waiting there by the till thinking...
Oh, literally, it was like a scrum around the till on Thursday. Everyone understanding what, trying to work out what they've sold.
Yeah, yeah.
And so all of that went on. And then I became the assistant manager to Nigel Lee, the guy who employed me. So it was owned by China Craft. And I'll just do a quick funny story. The guy who owned it is a guy called Gerald Lipton.
Right.
And if you were on duty as the manager or the assistant manager, you had to ring him every Thursday.
Right.
With the takings.
Okay.
And so every single shop he owned, every China Craft shop, every Pages shop, he had one in Kensington, one in Park Street, everyone had to ring him.
Before the internet, so these were like,
there's no internet,
really?
There's nothing. You're ringing with a number.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you'd ring him and his secretary would answer and she'd say, oh, you hang on, he's obviously, you're in a queue. So if it was me, I would be ringing up whether I was the assistant manager there or the manager in Park Street. Eventually, that's where I ended up. And you'd say, oh, we've taken, Shaftesbury Avenue would take £60,000 a week back in the mid-80s, through the till. And so you'd ring him up and say, oh, Mr. Lipton, it's 56,444.
We're talking about that phone call.
There'd be like a silence on the end of the phone. And he would say something like, did you open every day? Did you shut early? And so all of these things, like just, And so in the end, I kind of got to grips with it because his only reference point was what you took that week last year.
Right.
So if you'd have taken out a bumper week the year before, but you had a slack week a year later, it was like a disaster.
Mm.
So, I mean, this is back in the day. So Nigel, the manager, kind of understood all this. So he would say, okay, we'd take what we needed to take. Then the rest, you'd literally, I mean, physically put under the till and in the safe to catch up for the next week if it was a bumper week. It was a mad way of running the business, but...
Jesus.
Two things it taught you, that you need to be on your toes when you're working with a private company, yeah. You know, really entrepreneurial. Mm. And the other thing it taught me, because I had no background of it, was how to sell, how important it is to be able to sell things every day.
Yeah, yeah.
And that sales figure every day is such a lesson because, you
and
know...
It sits with you now.
Always.
Yeah, yeah.
It's constantly in the back of your mind that you need to sell.
Okay. So let's fast forward a little bit.
Yeah.
So, you know, because obviously we covered a lot about your history in season one, but... Yeah, when did you realise that you wanted to have your own company? Or did you not kind of realise, you just sort of fall into it?
I have absolutely no family history or known experience of being in a business.
Okay.
You know, my parents were not that way inclined. You know, yeah. We came from a very, you know, a normal background. Mm. My dad just worked, my mum was a cleaner, and my brothers, none of them, one is now, it's turned out that way, but none of us were like...
entrepreneurial.
No, not at all. We didn't even cross any of our minds, and we just wanted to earn a living with a job. And that worked. And I suppose I left Pages, and then I went to work for what was then called WM Steel, mm-hmm. and this pre-Hobart, and I was a London rep for them. Mm-hmm. And... I had a good couple of years there. I really learned how to be out on the road, mm-hmm. you know, like as a salesman, rather than being in a showroom. And I had my patch, I had my customers, I had my round, you know, and you really kind of understood. And their training back then, you know, I spent 3 weeks down in Hastings, where their manufacturing and their head office were, being trained. Mm. I mean, like nowadays, someone just gives you the car keys and you get on with it.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, you did proper training. And, yeah. and that was really, really good experience. And the other part of that was working in a team. There was 14 of us, within 14, and a national sales manager. And we had different areas over the country. And the camaraderie mm-hmm. of being in a sales team, and I'd not seen that. But basically, I'd come from a very, more of a an atmosphere of, you know, trying to hold on to your customers in the shop. Yeah. And not lose them to someone else if you've gone for a cup of tea. You know, this was like, this is your area. You're in it with everyone else. And, you're part of that group of people. Mm. And that was a really interesting thing to learn, how to work within a group of people. I think also what made that easier for me is that I'd come from team sport. I'd been part of a team.
So
there were loads of things that were parallel, you know, from working with that Steels team, who I still speak to almost all of them today, and being part of the football team. I mean, and it was that camaraderie, and I found that a really helpful thing for me during my time as a rep. And then they were bought by Hobart, mm-hmm. so there wasn't really room for everybody, which was really interesting. You know, when they bought Steels, they didn't want to keep all the guys,
yeah,
because they had their own guys, mm-hmm. and we found that hard actually. But it was part of life, you know. It was a buyout; it was a big buyout back in that day. And I remember going to see David Smithson, who was the MD of Hobart then, and he said, "Oh, you know, you can come work for us forever. You know, you can look after London. You can have a great career. You're a young guy." And I knew David a little bit, and so he would always say, I was the only person that turned him down, because in the gap between what was happening, I met a guy called Bill Downing.
Okay.
And he's the first person I met that made me think bigger, that it was a bigger world outside of what's happening in the UK, because he had worked internationally. And I met him, he was on a trip back from the Middle East. He'd worked in the Middle East right back in the Wild West days. Right. And he was coming back to the UK to run a company called Karen Strands. And Steels were one of the very early companies, so we're talking in the 80s, that started importing product.
Right.
So that's when I first saw a company called Juno, combination ovens, and Moreno, which was Cookline.
This opportunity to import.
And they imported and added to the product that they manufactured. But when Hobart bought Steels, they didn't want either of those products. And so I'd done quite well with Moreno in London. And the guys at Moreno recommended me to Bill Downey. So I didn't know Bill.
Okay.
And they recommended me. They said, I've got this guy in London, this young guy. And Bill was going to take on the Moreno agency because he had had it in the Middle East. And they said, oh, just you should contact this guy in London because he's been to the factory a few times and he's done, you know, he's done a lot of business in London. So I made contact with Bill and I met him in Heathrow. And he was coming back from a trip. And I was sitting in the lounge in the Radisson, and it was late. So I'm thinking he's not coming.
Mm.
And there was a woman sitting across the way in the lounge. And after about 20 minutes, she wandered over to me. She'd been looking at me.
Mm.
She wandered over to me and sat down and said, she just said, you and me are waiting for the same man. I'm thinking, I said, really? She laughed. She said, you're waiting for Bill? I said, yeah. She said, I'm Betty. I'm his wife. He's delayed on the plane. You can don't leave. He's coming.
Oh.
So, because I think she knew I was getting a little bit tricky. I'm getting a bag. I'm packing other things. And I said, oh, great. And he came. And we had a good chat and about what we were going to do, what Karen Strands was going to be. It was going to be Maiko and Elro and Moreno.
Okay.
And so I said, great. And he had advertised a job in the caterer. And so he said, I'm going to give you do you want the job? We agreed the salary. This is Bill. Mm-hmm. We agreed the salary. We agreed the job. We agreed everything. And I said, yeah, okay. I'm committed, you know, and I can tell Hobart that I'm going to come work for you. He said, great. I'll send you a letter. I said, great. So I said, what about all the people that replied to the ad?
Hmm.
And Betty just turned around and said, he won't even open them. I said, really? He said, no, he won't even look. He's made his mind up now, that's it. And that was how I started with Bill.
Okay.
And he, you know, if you ask me that question of who was the person in the end, after working with him for 5 years, showed you that it was possible to have your own business.
Yeah.
It was him, for sure.
Okay.
He took me from being a young rep in the UK. He showed me everything, factories, introduced me to people I would never have met. Took me on trips everywhere and really introduced me. And then when it came to the end of Karen Strands, we were owned by Frankie then. He sat down and, you know, we went to Moreno and Bill was going to open Maiko UK.
Yeah.
And he said, you can come with me.
Mm-hmm.
And, or you can go with Moreno and they'll help you and you can start on your own.
And was that really the start of your business?
That was the start. Really? That was the beginning of Moreno UK. And the Gribaldi family owned Moreno then. It was not Ali, it was mm-hmm. pre-Ali. And they helped me hugely. I mean, like financially, and they just gave me the pathway to opening the business. And I opened the business with them, literally found the premises, found some people, set the business up, employed some staff. And
so it was kind of a natural progression.
Yeah, really. It was so lucky where, you know, we sat in that meeting with Bill over at Moreno. And the family just said, what do you think, could Trevor do this? And people just went, yeah, of course, you know, he can do it. And literally that was it. They brought some money in and they gave me shares in the business. Mm-hmm. They were extremely generous and I was extremely lucky. And they helped me. They had a guy called Giancarlo Cosarin. He was like the general manager, really. And Ali kept him on in at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was a great friend to me and he would come over and... So he's a very Italian guy. He was a really big, white-haired, coat on the shoulders, beautiful watch. He had a fantastic watch. Smoked like a trooper, Dunhill lighter. I mean, classy guy. And I can remember meeting him for the first time with my wife. why they why. And we met up in London. So I wasn't really a huggy, I say it's hard to believe now, Rad, obviously. Mm. I wasn't really a huggy guy at all. And when he met me in the hotel, he came in and we said hi, and he gave me this massive hug, huge bear hug, and I'm hugging him back. And I could see the look on my wife's face. Yeah, yeah. It probably was the first time she'd seen me hug a guy.
Yeah.
Those were the days, you know, back then. It wasn't that kind of thing in the UK. But the Italian guys were brilliant, and that was how we started. And so that worked well, I mean, for quite a few years. And then Moreno got into difficulty as a business, and they were being looked at by Ali. Mm-hmm. And that was a worrying time, you know, because you're not really sure what's going on or what they were going to do.
Yeah.
You know, and I knew of Ali and there are other brands in the UK. I thought, well, you know, what's going to happen to me? And while we were doing the Moreno thing, we started working, when we came out of Karen Strands, with Roorg as well, the French bespoke cooking, and they were great. They went with me and said, "Yeah, we'll carry on." And
so were you exclusive ranges?
Yeah. So then, when that Ali thing with Moreno was coming to a head, I started exclusive ranges,
okay.
And I said to the guys at Moreno, the family, I said, "I'd like to just take this out of the business. So when that happens, it's not part of the Moreno deal." And they were good with that, and then I started exclusive ranges with a Roorg and a brand called Beach, the wood burning ovens.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
And
still looking after Moreno.
Yeah, both. We ran both things parallel, same office, same people, same. And so we had the sort of the Moreno sort of dealer business rolling along, and the high end back then gas bespoke cooking business on the other side, and that was exclusive ranges. And then the Ali thing happened, and they bought Moreno, and I retained my shares. So no one asked me to sell them, frankly. And Dr. Bertie came over to see me. Mm-hmm. And he said, "Everything's okay. We're going to leave everything as it is. Trevor, you're doing very well. It's fine." And I said to him, "I've got this exclusive ranges thing going on." He said, "That's great." He said, "No problem." So that carried on probably for 2 or 3 years. And during that time, exclusive ranges and at that import side of the business started growing a little bit harder. And as with Ali, that, you know, we were doing very well with Moreno, but they wanted us to do some other brands.
Yeah.
And that's when I said, "Yeah, great, we could do Ambag." I quite like the product. Mm. I'd seen the product a little bit, and I thought there's a space in the, you know, back then, and we could talk about where that space is not now, but back then there was a space between what we were doing with Moreno, which was mid-range modular, basically, and what we were doing with Roorg, which was very high range bespoke. And so we were being asked for something in the middle of that.
Yeah, yeah.
And
that. You saw that with Ambag.
Exactly. And so back then, Ambag was run by a guy called Herman Cheek and an R&D guy called Dieter Neumeister, who I still see now today. And I thought it was a fantastic product. I know Toby does a great job with it now, but I loved that product, really, absolutely. And we, together with Herman and Ilmar, we developed that System 900 brand with the one-piece tops, doing a bit more semi-bespoke stuff with the modules underneath. They did none of that when we started. Didn't do it. Herman didn't really want to do it. But we forced him to just develop the brand a little bit harder and make it a little bit more flexible as they went along, without being too much of a price issue. And we got that done. It was one of the most enjoyable parts of my career as someone looking at product.
Yeah.
Looking at equipment. And they made a brochure of the bespoke element, a separate thing, and they called it exclusive range. And I said, "You really helped us with this." And I thought that was lovely, because it was a real collaborative thing.
Yeah,
you know, back then, to get a modular business to become a semi-bespoke business, because it just took them away from the production line a bit, was a really big deal back then. It doesn't feel like a big deal today.
Yeah.
But back then,
it was a major.
It was a major thing.
I know. I think we, you know, and I hope you don't mind me saying, I know you've lost a yes, a colleague or
a partner. James was my partner.
A partner.
Yeah.
Recently, so.
So we
talk briefly about.
Yeah, of course.
Respect for him.
James, James and I started working together 30 years ago. So I'd started running the business as a purely an import business, and we were selling a lot of equipment to Hansons, and James worked there, and we sold a lot of raw granges to loads of really great people. His contacts, really, rather than mine. And then he fell out with Hanson, with Peter, you know, and that's how what life worked. But a lot of his customers wanted to go with him, and he had no structure. He was just like James, you know. And he left Hanson's, and he was sitting in his house with, like, loads of people ringing him saying, come do my project. So we were a major supplier with our brands into James's jobs.
Okay.
And that's how it started. I said, look, we just do these jobs that we've got on the go, were like for Gordon Ramsay and Tim, and we'll get them done. I'll help you finance them. It's not going to be a problem, and because I want the cooker business.
Yeah.
And we want that to go smoothly. You can do the rest of it. And then people went with him, people like Williams Refrigeration and fabricators, all chucked in to get these jobs done. That's how it started. And we said, we'll just do two or three of these jobs that are in the system now, and then you can start on your own.
Yeah.
As a designer, whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
And we kept that going for 30 years.
Wow.
I mean, really, because, and partly, well, mostly because of his customer base. We were just like friends. I mean, literally, they were like friends. And so it carried on with Exclusive for about a year. And then I thought, it's getting a bit messy now because we're turning into a company that does job projects.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we set up a different business, which I, that James and I owned between us, but he ran
that business. Yeah.
And we sold to him like a dealer.
Yeah.
And it was his customers.
Yeah.
It was his jobs, and we sold cookers to him, which worked brilliantly. And they gave him the freedom he wanted. He didn't really want to work for me.
Yeah.
No way. You know, we would have been a nightmare. Hmm. But he wanted his own little company, his own business. He wanted to do jobs that he could choose. You know, sometimes I would say, well, what happened to that job? He'd say, oh, no, we're not going to do that one. He said, too needy. And he would just not do it.
Wow.
And the amount of people that used to ring me and say, are you in contact with James? And I'd say, well, yeah. Hmm. He said, could you get him to ring me back? And he was like that, you know, and that is the way he worked. And it was a brilliant way for somebody with a creative way that he worked to operate.
Yeah.
It just suited him.
He clearly was very good at his job for all the work he was getting.
Look, let me say now, even after he passed away or stopped working, you know, for the last few months, people still come to me every day.
Yeah.
Saying, I didn't hear, or could you ask James to give you a ring? And they've not heard.
Hmm.
And the way that he worked suited a very particular kind of clientele. It wasn't a corporate thing. He never tendered stuff. He didn't do any of that.
Yeah.
It was just people who knew him and people who had worked with him for years and years and years.
And trusted him.
Yeah, of course, completely.
Hmm.
Absolutely a 100%. You know, to the extent where they'd say, James, can you come and look at this site for me? And they'd say, could we build a restaurant here? And he'd go, no. Can't get extraction out, too small, can't get this, doorway's the wrong way around, you'd have to cut the wood. And they go, okay, we'll move on.
Yeah.
I mean, literally, the trust level that he was given by the client was massive. So, yeah, it was a partnership, and it wasn't a partnership, really. You know, there were two businesses, but on the other side, we spoke every day.
Mm.
And I could never intervene on his design. I mean, he would just like say, you're not designing Trevor. But he loved intervening on what product we had. I thought he was great. He thought he was a product expert. I like everybody. And so in that way, he was always involved in what we're doing because he wanted to be. That was his nature.
Okay.
Yeah. So
sadly missed.
Lesson. Yes. Yeah.
So we're just gonna for this section.
Yeah.
We're in another 5 minutes. So
yeah.
What I wanted to talk to you about is, you know, recently you've introduced last year a new product, if you like, a new brand.
Yeah.
Because you've done a lot of importing of other brands, big brands. We talked about Ambac and Moreno and etc. So you started ER Bespoke, which is kind of your own brand, really.
Yeah.
Well, it is your own brand, isn't it?
You know, having spent all of that time looking after brands, the market has changed. You know, and things that have happened. Mid-range small manufacturing companies in Europe have really consolidated into some of the big guys.
Yeah.
So you've got the Middlebys and you've got the Allies and you've got the Electroluxes. They've picked up quite a lot of those sort of independent mid-sized manufacturing companies and dropped them into groups. So when we started looking at products, we were looking at independent companies in the main rather than companies that are with big corporations. And that got more and more difficult because
there aren't
many that are not attached.
Yeah.
And so I always thought that you could build a better partnership with a independent business rather than a group. You know, even though I'd worked in groups quite a long time, I understood how that worked. Mm. But brands, independent brands,
they're more nimble, I suppose.
They are, and the decision making is much
quicker. Yeah,
it's easier to deal with. You know, Menu Systems have Paul Schneider. Mm. He's the owner. If you want to do something, or he wants to do something, he will sit and talk to you, and you can decide.
Yeah,
and it's a call or it's a visit, and it's done. That's it. So that aspect. You've got a very small target of brands that you might want to work with that are not part of a big group. Mm. I'm not saying we don't ever do anything with a big group because we're working with Rosinox. But the Ali Group are slightly different because they do leave their brands to operate
autonomously. Yeah.
Mm. But nevertheless, it's a group. Mm. And so we looked at that and thought, well, what is happening to the market and has the market been affected by that? And I felt that, you know, we have always run with a modular brand and a bespoke brand.
Yeah.
Historically, that is what we've done.
Yeah.
But my feelings, not just with who we work with, but in terms of the market in general, that modular business is drifting too close to the bespoke business.
Yes.
In terms of market and price. Mm-hmm. And so this gap is closing. So I looked at that and I thought, well, you know, aspirationally, the market is looking for something like a high-end bespoke cooker, mm-hmm. because we are generally in the cooker business, and a mid-range modular. These two prices are too close now.
Yeah.
So what we wanted to do is say, okay, what could we do that will make people think the added value of a bespoke product in the mid-market sector?
Yeah.
What could we do that would make that happen? Finding manufacturer, mm-hmm. which we did, in terms of the structure, working with them. But the most important thing is, and that we've done, and that I've spent quite a lot of time doing, is looking at the appliances that are built into those cookers.
Yes.
And that has taken quite a lot of time, quite a lot of energy, quite a lot of money. But we've got to a place now where that ER Bespoke brand, and then to say, how do we brand that? And to have an own brand product line that you can add to, using independent suppliers, using manufacturers that you can go to and say, this is what the UK market's requiring.
Yeah.
So if I wanted, which we did, like a French plancher with different temperature zones, and if I want to build in electric grills, a really good example actually, because putting gas grills into bespoke cooking now is quite difficult because of legislation, mm-hmm. and so to find and develop with the manufacturer a really high performance electric char grill was a real priority, which we've done that, and we've put them into jobs, and we're branding that as part of our brand. So I think it gives you that flexibility to be able to say, we can build like this and we can supply appliances like this. But what we've had to do actually is come down in size and really work with some artisan manufacturers that are of very little interest to groups.
Yes.
They're just too small, if I'm honest. They just don't have that kind of like cachet, and they're not going to be bought. So all of that development has been done at that level to build something.
I guess using your years of experience with all different manufacturers, it's kind of like the natural progression,
it is,
really, isn't it?
Because
you've got that reputation that you can say, actually, this is our own brand.
It is.
Which is maybe ballsy, but it's also natural.
What you do is you go to those factories, particularly the Novo Mesto factory. Mm. You know, they're making the cookers for us, the carcasses, and we're building things into that. You know, you go there, and it's a huge company, and it's a brilliant company, actually. And they're at the beginning of their journey in cooker manufacturing, to be honest. So I go there and sit in front of 6 people from their design office to talk to them for an afternoon about making cookers. Mm. How they make them, what they do, how they drop things in, what they should be looking at, how they should be wired, how they should be made, how they could be split, what axis you might need, lots of different questions.
Yeah.
And they'll all be sitting there wanting to learn. It's a great thing to do.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is. It's been a really...
And the quality of that manufacturer is outstanding.
The making of it is no problem.
Yeah.
It's the understanding of the small elements that you pick up, or we pick up as we've gone along for the last 30 years. And said, don't do it like that.
How's it going?
It's very good. We on both sides, we're very, very happy with the appliance that we're building in, and we're going to be promoting those as appliances.
Yeah.
And we're very happy with the way the cooker's been built.
There's a synergy between number of suppliers and then bringing that together delivering that as a
solution. And everybody buys into that because they can just see like the end result. They can see what that looks like. Mm-hmm. Better knowledge for them, better for us. You know, it works very, very well. Yeah.
Okay. Well, Trevor, you've given us lots to think about. I'm going to ask you to
sit
quietly. Yeah, exactly. Sit quietly. No, it's been really good. And people always love to hear.
Thank you.
Your competitors, I'm sure, will love to hear.
Exclusive Ranges boasts over 25 years of industry know-how and an unparalleled record of service. Their client portfolio speaks volumes, encompassing 54 Michelin-starred restaurants, with over 200 kitchens installed and more than 3,000 cookers built. Exclusive Ranges supplies some of the most prestigious hotels and restaurants across the UK. Their unwavering commitment to supplying state-of-the-art professional kitchen equipment makes them the ultimate choice in the industry. To find out more, visit exclusiveranges.co.uk.
Paul, thank you for sitting patiently and smiling occasionally as your boss goes, tells us what's going on.
That's fascinating to hear the story, isn't it?
So, Paul, welcome to the show.
We've known each other
quite a long time.
A few years now.
A few years, I think. About the old Rationale days.
Yep.
You know, do you want to talk to listeners a little bit about like your role in to the sector? You, like me, are a chef.
Originally, I started on a work experience course from school at 14. With a small outside catering firm down on the edge of the New Forest, down in Southampton. And it was a great opportunity to join a very small business in from what looks like on the outside, but they ran several staff restaurants for the big manufacturers nearby. So there was a Millbrook Beds who are still down there. They used to run the staff feeding for order there, but they used to have sandwich rounds. They had predominantly outside catering, and the outside catering it was predominantly chefs from the old cruise lines.
Okay.
So as the cruise lines would dock and the chefs would, you know, say, I don't want to do another cruise, and they'd never put down roots. They'd always been on the boats, and predominantly they would start looking for jobs. And Tony, who ran the business, would employ them and put them up in accommodation nearby and everything else. So you had these wonderful chefs who sometimes were in their 70s, but the speed of what they did and their knowledge and the way they conducted themselves at 14, it was just, this is fascinating.
Yeah.
And it was the characters and the whole manner of everything. It was to do with catering and hospitality.
So you were chefing then? Were you chefing really?
Very much. I was washing up. I was,
okay,
I was prepping.
And then you moved
into I was kind of learning what I could. I mean, the opportunity to cycle up at kind of 5 o'clock in the morning and work with a baker was fascinating. You know, he was in his 80s. He had actually served in World War One. He had actually ran away from home at 14 and went and fought on the front line. It lasted 6 weeks. He had half his foot blown off. He had to come home and apologise to his dad, who was a baker, and so he put him to work in his thing, and he'd been a baker for the next 70 odd years of his life. And when you were learning and working with guys that they didn't weigh anything, they knew exactly what they were doing was just the way the flour felt in their hands and all, and working with these guys, the skill and everything else, I was just hooked and then carried on.
So sort of moving forward a bit into food service equipment, what was your first job? Was it rationale work or was it before that?
Well, the first time I kind of stopped the chefing, I was about 29. The kids were starting to get to that sort of age where, you know, chefing didn't really kind of suit family life and so forth. And I'd gone back to university to do a kind of a business course and everything else with sales and marketing with a view of getting into sales. And my first role in sales was actually Brake Brothers on the food service.
I
joined a fascinating team. It was a really strong team based out of Egham in Thorpe team. You know, there was quite a few of us came through that sort of route at the time. You know, John Stewart of Hobart, you know, was the business development manager at the time in the team, and you know, Lee Donkins, you know, joined later on. So there was quite a few of us that have now made our paths into
through
exactly the same teams, you know, that we had, and the training back in those days was fantastic. It was a really good kind of opportunity to learn sales, and like Trevor was saying earlier, that responsibility to make sure you're hitting your numbers every day and making sure you're selling every day and you're doing your call plans and your call routes and everything else. And it was that, you know, it was right on the coalface of that sort of learning, which was great, and that lasted really well for 5-6 years. And then you know, Brakes had sold out as a family business to kind of at the time CD&R, the investment companies, and that very much changes the dynamics of businesses like that quite significantly. There was an opportunity to join Rationale, that was the first step into catering equipment. And of course they regularly employed chefs,
kind of their standard thing.
You know, that was very much their standard thing. The fact that we came into it with some sales experience and all helps.
Was a bonus.
You know, absolutely. and so that was really my first route into catering equipment. Done that for a couple of years before joining what was an Otis at the time.
Steve
Loughton and Simon Frost and so forth. And that later became kind of Manitowoc and now Wellbeat and Annie Group and so forth. And that gave me an opportunity to learn various other brands and, you know, from fryers and cookers and cooking suites and everything else within those product ranges. So the understanding of the sector became very, very strong there. You know, I was meeting with an awful lot of the consultants. I was meeting with all the key directors and so forth of a lot of the projects. And we were getting more and more involved in those kind of those clients' needs, so we were understanding, kind of moving from that kind of traditional sales, which I'd done at kind of Brakes and those sort of companies,
sort of
much more into that problem solving and that consultancy and that development role and that solution sell, you know, which is, you know, often the route into the market now, and is probably 90% of what we do now is that solution sell. It's understanding what those clients' needs are and finding a solution to fit their.
So then
their
was that next move was into Holton.
The next move was into Holton for the thing. I had a great opportunity to work with Phil Gibson, you know, who sadly passed at the end of last year and sadly missed from the industry. But the knowledge that you have when you're working with individuals like that is just fascinating, you know. And I had a number of good years there. And then about 2.5 years ago, Trevor approached. He had taken on it's kind of fallen into a Viannan role, you know, and kind of in his illustrious meetings and his prowling around stands at shows, had a long-term relationship with Viannan and helped him a lot during COVID with a handful of projects in association with James. And they were looking at kind of formalising that and doing something a bit more structured in the UK. It just seemed to be a good opportunity to come and do something a little bit different and bring the brand that had always been here, but had never really kind of necessarily committed to a structured route.
So you kind of head up that?
Very much. That's pretty much my day-to-day. Is anything in the air is mine, and everything below
it. And for just the listeners, what is Viannan? I mean, just so... Viannan is we know what Holton and Viannan is, but people might not know.
Absolutely. Viannan is... they are a factory over in the Netherlands, family-run business, you know, which fits the portfolio of what Exclusive Ranges goes and represents. Mm-hmm. They manufacture canopies.
Okay.
And a whole range of ventilation canopies, and that's really what they do. So they have kind of their basic entry level ranges, they have their middle range, the Jetstream side, and then they have their V-Energy 2 painted systems, and the V-Energy 2 in particular can reduce your airflow requirements by up to 28%.
Okay.
And when you start looking at that, that's saving on the extract route, but that's also saving on the supply route and the heating and the cooling and the problems you often get associated
ducting,
with it.
The
ducting, the plant, and the cost of all of that can be quite significant. So the savings at that front end is significant, especially if it's designed well at the front end of the project. And there was an opportunity. That was very unique. They're a leader around the globe in that sort of product range. They've been established for 45, 50 years. And it was a really good opportunity to bring something like that into the marketplace.
How are they actually doing that? You know, like reducing the... On that premium product, reducing the airflow... almost a third, really, I suppose.
They've developed a painted curve on the inside of the canopy.
Okay.
So on the front thing, it's actually the last few inches of the curve. It enables a tumbling effect into the canopy.
Okay.
So the plume of the cooking plume naturally wants to come out of the canopy. That's what it wants to do. And the purpose of the canopy is to try to contain it in there and extract it out at the back. So you see various technology. We have Jetstream, which is an air curtain around the outside of the canopy that kind of extends with an air curtain the depth of that canopy, which just helps with that containment. But it's when the air is tumbling up into the canopy, it's spinning it and allowing it to stay and pool inside there. It just gives the extract a little bit more time just to take it away.
Okay.
And that's really the trick to it.
So it's just a little bit of a dwell time there.
It's a little bit of a dwell time within the kitchen canopy that allows it to then go.
Because someone wants to explain, maybe it might have been you actually, explain to me that air, you know, it's a bit like water, you know, like it will find the route of least resistance.
Absolutely. It will always want to try to escape. If it's got an encouragement of a draft from a window or from a ill-placed...
We can't see it, but that's kind of how it moves.
Absolutely. That's exactly what it wants to do.
Yeah.
And so it will always go the path of least resistance. And that's why you need to have the right size canopy, you need to have the right size baffles and so forth.
Mm.
You want to keep that balance of static pressure across all of those filters.
It is a real science.
I enjoy it. I get the backup from some fantastic guys in the factory as well, which is always helpful. It's not as scary as everyone seems to think it is, but it's very easy to get it wrong. That's the problem.
And when it goes wrong?
When it goes wrong, it tends to be very difficult to get it right.
Yeah.
You know, it tends to get expensive to get
it right. So to sort of... I mean, maybe we'll get into a bit more detail when we have a group chat, but to mitigate that, you know, it's obviously, you know, you're in charge of Viannan extraction manufacturer, fundamentally, if you like. How do you mitigate that risk of getting it wrong, if you like?
It's just experience. It's just, you know, there's always things you can see. There are, you know, 90% of the problems you have when people are saying they've got extraction problem, it's probably supplier. And that's the first thing. You quite often see a kitchen door, and you might sit in the restaurant and you see the kitchen door is either stuck open, and particularly if it's a swing door, you'll see it either in the kitchen or in the restaurant. It's not actually just closed where it should be. And that's normally an air imbalance, you know, and you can start seeing these sort of things. And there's all little lessons. Most of the time, it's ceiling diffusers too close to the canopy to bring some extra air in for the chefs. Yeah. And what that's doing is creating an air curtain across the actual containment of the canopy. And you just sit there and go, well, it's such a simple mistake.
And so the air from the cooking is going everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely, because it's being stopped from getting into the canopy because there's a blast of air coming across it. And so there's various little things that you can see on a, you know, and it tends to be small changes. They are small details, but they make a massive impact at the other end of the project.
And as in your role, what's like an average day for you? Is there an average day?
I would love to know if there was an average day. One minute I'm driving all over the country doing site surveys first thing in the morning, working with install teams, overseeing the deliveries. The next thing I'm in with consultants running through kind of future schemes and developments. I'm selling into the dealers and supporting the distribution partners that we have throughout. The next thing I'll be at an NC conference and doing the exhibitions and occasionally we even end up in a room doing a podcast. That was a surprise.
So doing everything. Is there kind of, maybe not in this job, but is there in your food service equipment career, like a tough moment in your career, and if there was, what did you learn from it?
I think you always have tough moments. I think, you know, on the road it can be quite lonely. I mean, we're doing a lot of hours, you know. It's not unusual to be leaving at 4:30 in the morning and to get up to meetings at, you know, halfway across the country and be traveling back late at night. It's always difficult when, you know, in certain companies you've been chasing numbers, you know, and you know, you're under pressure for hitting targets and so forth, you know, and in that sales environment that's quite common. In the project side, you know, you're constantly occupied by trying to make sure those projects are done. Have we ticked all of those boxes? Have we got everything organized? Is all of that right? So I think it can be, you know, quite a challenging time out there, and I think you have to be mentally resilient, you know, and I think that's the thing. You've got to understand what makes you tick and give yourself time to relax at certain times. You know, for me, it's a dog walking in the New Forest. You know, that's my
sanctuary. You still live down there, the New Forest?
I still live down there, and very nice part of the world. You know, and it's a great place to walk the dog.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to ask you a few more questions about Vianna and the things like that. But what I'm going to do is just we'll take a short break, if that's okay.
Yep.
And then we're going to invite Trevor back in.
Yep.
And I've got a few more questions for you as well about Vianna. So
yeah, I'm thank sure you so have. Far. Thank you.
Welcome back. We're going to invite Trevor to join us, and Paul's still with me. Welcome back, gentlemen.
Very good.
Hello.
Had a little break for a moment. So on this section, we're going to talk a little bit about sort of collaboration, partnerships. I want to get a little bit more about sort of maybe some hints and tips with extraction and that kind of thing as well. So, I mean, I'll put it out there. How important, and it's a cliche question, but I'm going to ask it, how important are these sort of partnerships that you've got with your different manufacturers and suppliers, and how do they work day to day?
So it's very important, I would say, that you've got manufacturers you work with that have been long-standing people that understand how it works in the UK and enable you to explain to them how it works in the UK. Because I think what particularly in, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, the way we work here as a supply chain to the way the mainland Europe works is different.
Okay.
And part of building that partnership with those manufacturers or people that you're working with is to try and explain the difference to them without them thinking, he would say that, wouldn't he? Because he just wants it for himself and, you know, and for selfish reasons.
Yes.
And I have had varying degrees of success over the years with doing that, if I'm honest.
Yeah.
And it's slightly changed now in terms of accessibility to the market and what you might want from that and what you might not want from that. But when we're talking with manufacturers at the very beginning, we really like to understand what their thoughts are in terms of the future, because no one cares when you're not selling anything. So you can talk to a manufacturer at the very beginning and they say, well, yeah, it's okay, we'll just give it a go and see how you get on. And all of a sudden you're selling £300,000-£400,000 a year. And so the manufacturer then is interested because you've made a good start and you've started working with them. And all of a sudden they're thinking, well, you know, actually we'd like to access the market in a slightly different way, Trevor, you know. So the route to a good partnership starts at the very beginning for everyone to understand what the business is.
Yes.
And where we're going. And that solves like 90% of the problems.
Mm.
Because everyone understands, like we started with Heidebremer.
Yeah.
The grill people. Very, very nice people. Very small company. And a tiny bit of success here. Just one or two grills. And I went and explained what we could possibly do for them. And now that could possibly work. And we put a package together for now, for the future, and down the road. And we all understand what that might look like as we move along with the business. If it doesn't go exactly to plan, then fine, we can all review that. But it's very, very important that we all understand the pathway.
Yes.
What the expectation levels
what
are.
What success looks like, I guess.
Exactly. Because at the beginning, you could do a deal. But if it's not the right deal going into the future, then you are definitely going to become unraveled.
Yeah.
It really is very important. Like, and we have been, when we started doing that with the own branding, it was a slightly different conversation, because what we're asking manufacturers to do is to make something and not put their name on it.
Yeah.
Put our name on it. And then asking other manufacturers to drop things in and build things within that structure without their name on it. And so it's quite interesting, because some manufacturers are very cool about that.
And some aren't.
And some are not. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so,
but also a massive risk for you, really, because ultimately it's your name on the table, isn't it, really?
It is.
So you've got to, you know, you have, yes. I know you have, get your ducks in a row in terms of quality, and I know that because that's what you do. But, yeah. But
we acknowledge that. And so, and then our job, in any case, is add value, take responsibility.
Yeah.
So when you're importing, people can turn around and say, I should just be able to buy this from the factory. And you know, not from you, Trevor, you know, not with your markup on it or whatever they want to say. I mean, these are the things people say. But if you add value...
Not quite as simple as that.
It's not as straightforward. If you add the value and show people that you're adding value with service, with backup, with knowledge, with working with the factory, with structure.
Yeah.
And then go forward with that and show them how that works over a long period of time. Then people these days are more than happy to buy from I'm going to call it an importer, third party, whatever you want to do. But the most important thing, you've got to add the value in the market, and you've got to have and to do that, you have to have the right partnership at the other end.
Hmm.
You know, when we took Vianen, we'd worked with Vianen on many of James's projects. We helped them out in the UK, ad hoc, Brexit. We needed help with logistics and paperwork and all of these things, and they were doing that themselves before. And then we decided to have a more structured approach, as Paul explained. But that took some working out.
Yeah, yeah.
As to what the expectation were at our end and what the expectation was at their end. And we've done that. But immediately, you've got to keep your side of the bargain. I can remember starting, and Lisa Vianen, the daughter of the founders, said, it'll be busy straight away, Trevor. And I said, oh, yeah, okay. Well, you've been out of the market for 10 years and you've only been using us ad hoc, so let's not get too worried. I mean, I literally said that to her. And she said, no, Trevor, we're a worldwide brand.
Wow.
It's going to be busy.
And was it?
Absolutely. My desk was full of Vianen inquiries. So my responsibility then isn't to say, I'll give this a go myself, because I don't know enough.
To bring someone in.
It's to say, my input is, Paul,
bring an expert.
And structure. bring in some expertise to develop that business. And so then Rhiannon think Trevor's keeping his part of the bargain, and I'm thinking they're keeping their part of the bargain.
Mm.
And that is how a partnership goes along.
Definitely. I mean, Paul, from your perspective, I hear people sort of say, oh, the UK market is difficult. You know, I hear this from outside the UK. And also we've seen some brands that have tried to come to the UK, maybe not, no disrespect to them, maybe not fully understood, it is quite a discerning customer base, and then they've fallen flat on their face. And once you get it wrong once, we don't suffer fools very gladly. I mean, what, you know.
Well, yeah, and you've seen that over many products and many, many different sectors. Rhiannon's a little bit different. They've got a quality product and they've got experience in delivering worldwide on what they do. What we're trying to do now is educating the marketplace to the options that's available to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're adding a structure and a consistency for installation, the service, the backup, the support, you know, the training, and showing that it's a long-term structure and a long-term package that can be delivered. The benefits of that is the expertise that comes with that, you know, and that in the past has been inconsistent where, you know, they've entered the marketplace directly with different individuals that have come and gone in very short periods of time.
Right.
And you know, so offering that stability to the marketplace, you know.
Yeah. And that's confidence.
With a quality and trusted brand in the first place, it works.
Yeah.
You know, and that's really the goal of what we're trying to achieve in this partnership.
And we're talking about partnerships and culture, and I'm going to ask you a difficult question now. How do you handle disagreements? I mean, surely disagreements, I know you're not going to admit it, but surely disagreements come along. We all have them.
In
terms of maybe between a customer or manufacturer, or when there's a disalignment, I say disagreements or a challenge. I mean, how do you?
It's the same as anything. It's based on the information you have and the relationships you have.
Mm.
You know, if there's an error somewhere, you've got to identify what that is and put that right.
Yes,
yeah. That's as simple as it gets, isn't it?
True. So it's got evidence based and
absolutely. There's no point hiding from a tough decision. You know, it doesn't go anywhere. You just got to you got to understand what's caused that problem and resolve it.
So we're going to do a quick fire round, if that's all right.
Okay,
both of you just go for it and condense short answers for me. Most underrated bit of kit.
Well, certainly the canopy.
That is too much. Oh, I would say chef's knife.
No, oh, I like that. Most oversold. God, I could think of one.
Avocados.
Avocados.
The devil's food.
Kit. Also a bit of equipment.
Could be a bit of kit. Well, it could be anything. I like avocados. Air fryers. Bloody hell, everyone bought an air fryer, didn't they?
That's a very good shout, air fryer. I'm refusing to buckle to air fryer. I'm under air fryer pressure at home.
Are you?
Yeah, because my kids have got it. My wife's saying, well, we can just not turn the oven on and use an air fryer. I said, no, it's okay. Air fryer's good. I'll go with air fryer.
Great.
I was also, commercially, I was going to say, you know, the little Vario thing.
Yeah.
I'm not a mess.
Yeah. Okay.
Too much space.
Let's not go there.
Yeah.
Favorite city to work or visit? In fact, you give me both.
Work.
Visit and work.
The most fun I've had working in a city is in Milan.
Milan. Cool. Paul?
London for me. It just reinvents itself all the time.
And to visit? And
the challenges.
Visit in general, I like America. So I recently went to Boston and I really enjoyed that. I do like going to America.
Yeah, I love it. LA,
Santa
Monica.
Yeah.
Paul?
I had a great time in Krakow.
Wow. Maybe we're going deeper with that. This is a clean podcast. This is a clean podcast.
We can do another kind of podcast with that.
You're on the road, and what's your sort of guilty pleasure meal? You could be flying, travelling, driving, whatever.
Driving, whatever you want. Definitely. And Isabel will be laughing at this. She calls it, because she's not a meat eater, she says, my guilty pleasure, even if you actually say porky product. I'm such a sausage roll.
Bacon bat. I'm all over that.
pastry, porky, pork pies, pie.
Yeah, love it.
Yeah, love that.
Drive-through coffee. That's the best invention ever for a drive-through. You know, how did we do without coffee in a drive-through?
Yeah. Well, that's a problem. It's dangerous, isn't it? Because you can do quite a lot of coffees, and
totally.
And just a sort of couple more final ones. What do you like to do to relax? Weekend or whatever.
As I said earlier, the dog walk through the forest. It just clears your head, doesn't it?
As long as it doesn't attack any of the wild horses.
No, he's good as gold with all of that. he's good as gold with all of that. So there's no risk of that.
So I still ride the bike a bit, which is a good thing. I've just started, and I've had a rowing machine for quite a while in the house, like a nice one. I've just started using it in the last few months properly. Okay.
The rowing.
The rowing machine, yeah.
Oh, wow. It's so good for you.
I've really enjoyed it, actually.
Yeah.
So there's that. And
it's the best fitness, that is.
The other thing I have started doing is non-work reading.
Okay.
I found myself reading only about work, and I still like predominantly work things. Yeah. But I got bought a really lovely Christmas present.
Mm.
Is it the Durant Bookshop?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a book a month, and you give them a profile. Well, I didn't. Isabel did. Mm. The kind of things you like.
Oh, well, and what's that called?
And they send you a book a month. It's the Durant Bookshop. And so it's like a gift.
Well, you send it back, or you?
No, you read it. You take it. You take your chances. Oh, and they've got a profile on you. So if it goes slightly wrong, you can change that profile. But I've got one, and I got a really lovely novel that I've started reading, and I think that is just going to push me to do more social reading. And I think that is quite.
That's two things you give me today, Trevor.
Do you like that?
One. Everyone's the prettiest girlfriend. And two, a book a month's gift. That's it. I'm banking those two. Honestly. Every time I meet you, it's a mind of information. So just to wrap up the podcast, 2026, for exclusive ranges, try to condense it for me. What are you hoping for? And maybe a little bit like, where do you see this year going? We know it's going to be a tough year because of the geopolitics and everything's going on out there. Trevor, do you want to kick us off with that?
I think really to develop the ER Bespoke branding.
Yeah.
The appliances and the cooking, the cooking islands. A bit of consolidation with brands. I think focusing in on the ones that really work for us and making decisions about that.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think trying to get that message through to whether it's the dealers or when that's through NC, which has been a good success for us, and the consultant market of what we actually offer. And I think that we've got work to do there where we can show people some of the product and some of the development that we've got in the business that will help everybody. And that is it's a really interesting messaging thing that we want to do. In general, the market's going to be tighter, no question about that. It's going to be more competitive, and people are going to have to really knuckle down.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And like you said before, it's about focus. It's about, rationalisation.
What do we do well?
Yeah. Paul, for you, in terms of, you look after Rhiannon.
I mean, it's very much in the same sort of way. You're looking at, whilst the market is tightening and whilst the opportunities may be a little bit less out in the marketplace, those that are looking to invest are doing it for a long-term purpose. It isn't a short-hit market right now. So the conversation's then about decarbonising the businesses, bringing down your energy costs, which we're all seeing increasing on a regular basis. There's no better way than to get your product design right at the front end and save those costs all the way through the business. And I think that collaborative approach where we can talk to people about their cooking ranges and their solutions of what they're trying to achieve, but also partner that up with a good ventilation design. You know, that adds a benefit to clients and customers, and that has to be the key message for us to deliver out into the marketplace.
Okay, and what do you think your outlook on, you know, for the wider food service sector?
I think there's some challenges there, you know, but challenges that have been coming and going forevermore. I mean, we saw it. You know, you see these trends going through the businesses. One year it's all about CPUs and going into kind of central production kitchens, you know, and then all of a sudden it's about local food, and you'll see it kind of as a general cycle. I think the sector, you know, people always want hospitality. And so I think it's just about making sure you've got a simplified offering. We are seeing more and more brands now being very simple in their offering and being quite selective in what they deliver into the marketplace. They're staying in their wheelhouse and they're becoming the best in their wheelhouse. And I think that will continue. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's still a drive for institutional catering. I think the little cafes and things to keep things local, I think all of that is working really well. I think people are still working from home an awful lot. So, you know, I think the leisure market has changed completely. You know, your weekends have got longer slightly, but your working week has got different. You know, you come into London now on a Monday and a Friday, it's significantly quieter than what it used to be. So I think markets adapt. I think they take opportunities, they adapt, they can be quite clever. And I think it's just a case of understanding the marketplace and moving with those trends that are coming through. And hopefully that'll steer everyone in the right direction.
Okay. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
It's a rainy day. Hope you've enjoyed it.
A lot.
Very much.
Thank you.
Great. Well, that concludes the podcast for this episode. We've heard there from Trevor and Paul about the different brands in their company, exclusive ranges. And it's really been interesting to delve a bit deeper into Trevor's story. And again, just to remind you, if you want to hear more about that, it was episode 8 of season 1. And to find out more about exclusive ranges, you can visit them on exclusiveranges.co.uk. And we can find all about their products and also get in touch with Trevor or Paul. I'm sure they'd be delighted to talk to you.
Yes, look forward to it.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you've got any comments, please pop me an email at radford@kitchencuriosity.co.uk. Or if you've got time, please rate the podcast. You've been listening to Kitchen Curiosity, and I've been your host, Radford Chancellor.
Kitchen Curiosity is written and hosted by Radford Chancellor and is edited and produced by Tom Anderson. Kitchen Curiosity is a Sound Rebel production.